listening to the Diplomat's podcast on Asian geopolitics. As always, I'm your host, Ankit Panda, an editor at the Diplomat, and I'm joined today by Scott Chaney Peters, founder and chairman of the nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank, the Center for International Maritime Security, otherwise known as CIMSEC. As a disclaimer, I will note that everything Scott says on this podcast represents his own views and not those of the U.S. government or the U.S. Navy. Scott, thanks a lot for joining me.
Yeah, pleasure to be here.
And just as a brief aside, I should note that I'm also a proud member of CIMSEC. It's a fantastic organization, and if you're not familiar with what CIMSEC does, I'd very much recommend you go check out their website at CIMSEC.org. If you're interested at all in maritime security or naval issues, there's simply a ton of great content that shows up on that website, so definitely keep an eye on what they do. The reason I have Scott on today is because a few weeks ago, maybe back in June, an article that Scott wrote caught my eye. He wrote it over for CSIS, for their Asia Maritime Transparency Initiative, on India's Maritime Acts East. That was what the title of the article was. And it was essentially looking at how India is beginning to operationalize its Act East policy with naval deployments and other such endeavors towards Southeast Asia. And as listeners of our recent podcast episodes will know, Southeast Asia has obviously been a bit of a hot flashpoint recently, particularly in the maritime sphere, with tensions racking up in the South China Sea, with China's assertion of its sovereignty there, and a whole variety of other issues. So, Scott, I guess to start off this podcast, why don't you kind of walk us through a bit about, you know, how India is specifically operationalizing its Act East policy in your eye? It seems so. Just by way of background, India's Act East policy is something that came up recently in after Prime Minister Narendra Modi was elected in May 2014. The Look East policy was an Indian statement of its policy back in the early 90s. During the era of liberalization after the Cold War, India was a little bit adrift, and it essentially said that it would look east towards these rising economies in Asia. So anyway, Scott, I'm going to pass it over to you. Tell me a bit about the Act East policy and how India is operationalizing it in a maritime sphere.
Yeah, thank you. Absolutely. So first, if you'll permit me, I would love to just plug briefly the I know you plugged CIMSEC, but we're also doing our first crowdsourcing phase of our first war game. So if anybody's interested in participating, I know we've got a lot of knowledgeable listeners to this podcast who would provide us some great feedback and participation. They can do so. It's focused on the South China Sea, and they can go to the website, as you said, CIMSEC.org/wargames, and they can join that way. But yeah, as far as the Act East policy and operationalizing that, it's what I said in the CSIS article was it's not really something that's necessarily new, the Act East policy, what it means in implication or in operationalization. These are a lot of trends that have just been continuing and been ratcheting up over the past, 15, 25 years, as far as increased bilateral engagement and exercises, whether you're talking about with Japan or Singapore recently, and Australia, they've just agreed to start their own bilateral annual engagements and exercises with them, or increasing deployments, these what are called Eastern Fleet operational deployments or overseas deployments. And these started out as kind of one ship deployments, maybe doing goodwill port calls in the 90s. In the 2000s, they became this greater participation with these maritime exercises. And you started to see these multi-ship regional deployments. And in the past 10 years, you've seen them evolve into what they are now, where they've got these multi-ship deployments, doing multiple port visits, doing multiple exercises. They do these coordinated patrols with countries like Indonesia and Thailand. And they join in a lot of these different exercises. And so it's really been just the trajectory continuing. But as you said, since Modi came into office, it's not even just been the Act East portion, but a great focus on the maritime security and the Navy more broadly that you've seen than in previous governments, including with the Andaman and Nicobar Command, sitting at kind of the gateway to the Malacca Strait. I was speaking with a retired high-level Indian naval officer earlier this week who said that since the Modi government came into power, that there's been a lot of the barriers that had previously existed to developing some of these commands and bases on or at Andaman Nicobar Command, ANC, have kind of fallen by the wayside, just a greater realization of the potential for engagement in the East and developing the capabilities that would enable that engagement.
So from a U.S. perspective, how does Washington see India as a player in the South China Sea? Obviously, I can imagine that the United States would like to see India play a larger role in that region. India is, for all intents and purposes, at least in the South China Sea, a status quo power. It's not interested like China is in upending the state of affairs there. So, what is the sense you get around Washington for how India can be a productive player in the South China Sea?
Right, absolutely. So the one thing that happened recently was Defense Secretary Carter's visit to India in May, which was kind of a follow-up to the president's visit to the prime minister back in January, which was really a historic visit. And what you see a lot of times coming out, the alignment in this, as you said, a status quo power, this emphasis on freedom of navigation, a lot of the communication that comes out is this joint communication, emphasis on freedom of navigation, the importance of maritime security and cooperation. So a desire to not see any particular country claim excessive maritime rights, not naming any names, but it's kind of clear who might be the one claiming those excessive maritime rights. But the way that India then takes this to does this is a lot of mostly diplomatically, but they have been supporting Vietnam in a lot of ways. Recently through some what I like to call patrol boat diplomacy, extending lines of credit, offering I think it was $100 million to buy 4 patrol boats, so boosting some of the lower end maritime security capabilities that India might not want to be too involved itself in, maybe joining joint patrols or something like that, but would like to see that the other players in the region help to provide that some security on the eastern end of the Malacca Strait and into the South China Sea. And again, partly the reason for doing this is its own economic security. It's got a lot of great resource exploitation deals, oil and gas with Vietnam. So it's kind of looking to protect some of those investments. But then also with the sort of expansion of Chinese naval power into the Indian Ocean region, you see maybe for some prestige issues or prestige reasons, some desire by India to almost mirror that expansion of the theaters. So if China's going to be acting more assertively or be more involved in the Indian Ocean region, India might be a little bit more present, a little bit more active in the South China Sea. Not necessarily that I think they're going to come to blows anytime soon, but just more of a mirroring of for prestige reasons and wanting to show that they have those capabilities as well.
Right. I mean, when you were talking about Vietnam, actually, it reminded me of how Carter announced $18 million in U.S. funding for Vietnam to acquire maritime patrol boats. After the embargo was lifted last November, the United States is now selling Vietnam military equipment specifically for the purposes of ameliorating its maritime security. So just when you look at what India is doing with Vietnam and what the United States is doing on a security front, it seems like there's a very, close degree of cooperation there. I actually just want to take a step back to the Andaman and Nicobar issue and just point out as an aside, the Malabar exercises are coming up later this year with the United States and India, and Japan is looking to become a permanent part of these exercises. Malabar 2007 is obviously the one everybody talks about, which was a massive exercise that, drew China's ire because it was seen as a concert of democracies coming together in Asia to kind of encircle China, prevent its rise. So essentially India and Japan backed off a bit after that. And since then the Malabar exercise has mostly been a U.S.-India exercise with Japan intermittently, but never U.S.-India and Japan in the Indian Ocean region. So now it's going to take place in the Bay of Bengal, but unfortunately they're going to be using the standard Eastern Naval Command, from what I understand, to coordinate these exercises both in Visag and in Chennai. So unfortunately they won't be using Andaman and Nicobar, since that would bring that exercise just out a bit further into the Indian Ocean geographically, but maybe that's something that can be done in the future. Scott, while we're talking about Malabar, what is your perception of this upcoming Malabar iteration? Do you think it's going to be an important, an important milestone for the U.S.-India-Japan trilateral?
I really do, especially if, and to your earlier question, I do think that the U.S. would love to see, Japan made a permanent member of the Malabar exercises, and Australia for the same reasons that, you know, India might be a little bit hesitant to make them so, you know, not wanting to be seen as countering, you know, doing these to specifically aim at countering, you know, China's rise, because, you know, China or India obviously has a lot of common interests, just like these other countries do with China, and is not seeking to, you know, anger China in doing so. But I think the U.S. would love to see, you know, Australia joining future iterations of Malabar again, especially if Japan was there as well, you know, and whoever else really wanted to be able to participate, because these are some of the more capable exercises, the more intense exercises, if you will, that happen in the Indian Ocean. You know, some of the more capable ships and different types, if you're talking anti-submarine warfare, some of the things that don't happen in a lot of the bilateral types of exercises that might be just as simple as, you know, signaling exercises and not real test of the different capabilities people have.
Right, absolutely. Let's talk a bit about our Carter's visit and specifically the scope that you see for U.S.-India cooperation on defense technology. Specifically, the big ticket item that a lot of people are talking about in India is the second indigenous aircraft carrier project, the INS Vishal, which will be India's 65,000-ton aircraft carrier, and it's supposed to be the most advanced with any Asian Navy, essentially, when it goes into operation. But there's talks that, you know, the United States and India could come together on this project, and India could end up implementing EMALS, which is General Dynamics' new electromagnetic aircraft launch system, which has a whole range of benefits that I've talked about in The Diplomat before. And also there's the possibility of nuclear propulsion, which is a bit more of a pipe dream, I'll admit. But essentially, you know, the U.S. and India are looking to cooperate on these major projects. India's obviously been a power looking to modernize its Navy for, you know, for at least the past two decades with a sustained attention. So what is your sense of where these projects are going, Scott? Are you optimistic? Do you think the Indian observers who are talking up this sort of cooperation are a little bit too optimistic on their end? I don't know. What's your sense?
Right. No, I am cautiously optimistic, I guess I would say. I do think that this is a great opportunity, and, you know, kind of the early signs, as you mentioned, the as part of Carter's visit, this was kind of one of the sort of Pathfinder projects of talking about developing a working group to look at, you know, exchanging carrier technology, and as you mentioned, EMALS and nuclear propulsion, both of which are kind of sensitive technologies, and so even the fact that this working group is meeting and discussing potentially helping out India is a good step forward. It's not something that's going to, you know, turn the relationship on its head overnight, and the carrier is certainly not going to be built overnight. There's a lot of things that need to be done before that happen within India as well. But I do think it's a positive sign. It was just recently, this past month, that, you know, India put out those essentially a request for proposal from a lot of different or for information from a lot of different companies, and several of those were U.S. companies. So it's a potential that it could go elsewhere as far as the, you know, design collaboration. But I think the fact that the U.S. has kind of got an early foot in the door is a positive sign. And similar, as you said, you know, India is looking at this extensive modernization. Their goal right now is a 200-ship Navy by 2027, which itself might be a little bit ambitious. They're at 137 currently, but they're looking to spend $61 billion over that 15-year or 12-year time frame. And so there's, you know, not just the carrier as a potential for increased U.S.-India collaboration. And again, somebody I was talking to earlier this week, you know, mentioned the recently announced six submarine class project that's coming up, the Chakra 3 class nuclear submarine, which they're looking to build their first indigenous nuclear submarines other than the nuclear missile submarine. And the Russians might have some early foot in the door there, but that's also something that the U.S. could consider if the nuclear issue is not too big of a concern getting involved with. So I think it's important for the U.S. to kind of keep the options open and not just get fixated on the IAC2 project as potential for further cooperation.
Great. So I think we've had a pretty good positive kind of lay of the land of India's, you know, maritime activities. I mean, obviously, this was a whirlwind tour. There's a ton more depth to this. You know, no pun intended. We're not talking about submarines, but there is really, you know, when it comes to Indian maritime issues, there's just so much to talk about. But Scott, I want to talk a bit about, you know, what India really should be doing. I think the issue of the South China Sea and acting east in itself is a little bit controversial in India. I know, you know, from Indian naval officers that I've talked to, both retired and presently serving, it seems like, you know, there is this broader discussion in India about obviously the Indian Ocean, which is seen as India's kind of backyard. It's kind of its primary maritime domain. And, you know, when you talk to people in India, you'll always hear about the Chinese String of Pearls, this network of civilian ports that China is setting up across the Indian Ocean littoral, beginning with, you know, Chittagong in Bangladesh, Colombo, Hambantota in Sri Lanka, Gwadar in Pakistan. But there's this perception in India that China is encircling them. And it doesn't help that, you know, we've seen confirmation, at least from the Pentagon, that China's Song and Shang class submarines have been operating in the Indian Ocean starting last year. So, you know, in your sense, how do you think the Indians should be looking to balance, you know, their commitment, obviously, to the freedom of navigation and the status quo in the South China Sea, but simultaneously build up a robust maritime presence in the Indian Ocean? And, you know, all of this is putting aside the issue of Pakistan, which is, you know, looking to acquire its own submarines. And when it comes to Indian strategic thinking, Pakistan is always, you know, the primary threat that India is planning around. So anyways, why don't we just talk through a few of these issues? So let's start with, you know, the Indian Ocean. What's your perspective on that?
Yeah. No, I mean, that's a great point. And I do think that the Indian Ocean is going to remain, you know, the main focus of Indian efforts for, you know, both naval and maritime security capabilities. And that goes into not just the, you know, naval capabilities, but things like the you know, coastal surveillance radar network that's being developed throughout the region among several other nations. You know, Sri Lanka, the Seychelles, Mauritius, and those are specifically not designed to target incoming naval vessels or submarines. They might be able to help in that capacity, but I think that takes a greater approach, sort of a whole government approach, looking at the, you know, enforcement of illicit fishing, talking about environmental issues, talking about counter-piracy, talking about counter-terrorism. So it's, you know, there's a greater emphasis these days, I think, on maritime security writ large as opposed to just the naval aspect. But also, you brought up a good point as far as the Pakistanis go. You know, that does remain, an issue of concern for India. And I do think that the, you know, development of their new nuclear ballistic missile submarine, the Arahant, is certainly a step towards kind of assuaging some of the fears that India might have. It's, you know, just an initial step. I know later this year they're hoping to get the, you know, submarine launched ballistic missile system that they're that would really make them capable as far as having the ability to have a good second strike capability. But with just that one submarine, you know, that wouldn't be able to do it. They're going to need several submarines and have those out on, you know, strategic ballistic missile patrol regularly. So, yeah, there's many issues that are focusing Indian minds on the Indian Ocean region. So I do think that the South China Sea is going to remain sort of a secondary theater, one that will stay important, but one that will remain second. And even with the Chinese, I know the general thinking is they've still got this, you know, Malacca Strait dilemma, so-called, where India, if it really needed to, could probably affect a lot greater strategic pain on the Chinese than China could in the near term with this, you know, the theory of the String of Pearls, just based on India's ability to interdict its economic security through interdiction of its energy imports. So,
right. Going back to the Pakistan question, that actually reminds me of the Coast Guard issue for India, which is also very important. The November 2008 attacks in Mumbai, part of the reason that they were possible is because the militants who carried out that attack simply, rowed a boat and walked onto India's shores in Maharashtra, walked into Mumbai. So, I mean, you know, recently the Indian Defense Minister Manohar Parrikar, I think in early January, there was another incident that was a little bit similar to that. I don't quite remember the details of something about either smugglers or terrorists. There was some ambiguity there. But I think there's also this concern in India that, you know, Pakistan could use the maritime route for its subconventional warfare against India. We just saw this last week that, you know, subconventional warfare is again spilling out of Kashmir. There was an attack recently in Punjab. So that's also something that the Indians are thinking a lot about. You know, while, you know, we mentioned the string of pearls a bit, and I know we're kind of jumping around this whole issue so much, but, you know, it's kind of nice to kind of think about these things from a 30,000 feet viewpoint now and then. You know, we've heard murmurings that China will set up its first overseas military base in Djibouti. Have you heard anything from, you know, Indian commentators or analysts about how they view this? Or if you haven't, you know, how do you think India will end up reacting to this?
No, that's a great question. You know, I don't think that I have heard anything specifically on Djibouti. And I do think that is going to be very soon that, you know, China does have that, you know, developed. You know, just even recently, there was a, you know, another bombing in Somalia that, you know, targeted a hotel where the Chinese diplomats, their embassy personnel happened to also be. And so kind of the thinking is that the Somali uncertainty and danger in that situation is also sort of driving Chinese thinking the need to have a more secure location in Djibouti. But I haven't seen much commentating on that issue from the Indians, but I'll admit I haven't looked for it specifically. So it might be out there and I just have missed it. But I do think that, you know, it might feed into those more conspiratorially minded, but I don't necessarily think that there's, you know, a great majority of Indians that think that the Chinese are intentionally trying to encircle them, or at least they shouldn't, because the Chinese are going to be more active in the Indian Ocean, but they've been active, you know, for the past, you know, 6-7 years, especially with the, you know, transiting out to doing these, those counter piracy patrols that the Djibouti base would support. And they're going to follow where their economic interests are, but it's really the, you know, following the economic interest, that's going to be the driver. And those ports, while they could, you know, foster some additional capabilities, they in and of themselves are not going to be the drivers of any sort of capability to encircle India. You might see, again, additional presence as far as the desire to protect those assets from the Chinese. But I don't think that the intention is to encircle India for any sort of, you know, nefarious reason.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that's kind of the whole idea underpinning the string of pearls, is this a threat perception asymmetry between India and China. Indians tend to see China as a much greater threat than Chinese ever think of India. So that's always, you know, something to keep in the back of your mind when talking about these issues, as you correctly pointed out. Anyways, Scott, thanks a lot for joining me on this episode. And, you know, I really thought that we kind of covered a massive swath of both geographic area and just content-wise. And again, I'll let you plug the SimSec, a simulation on the South China Sea. That sounds fascinating. And we'll look forward to the results of that. Thanks a lot for joining me, Scott.
Yeah, thank you for having me. And of course, on the Diplomat, there's many great articles that go more in depth into these issues as well. So be sure to check those out.
Thanks. We appreciate your plug. And if you like this podcast, as always, do go on iTunes and leave us a 5-star review and your comments for how we can improve this or bring on guests that interest you. Thank you.